Two locks and a cox.
From Devon's Radio X with Exeter Chiefs.
The next match against Bath is on Saturday the 20th of April. Book your tickets today at tickethub.exeterchiefs.co.uk.
Welcome to episode 35 of Two Locks and a Cox with myself, Chris Bentley, the handbrake of Rugby Union Podcasting, Ian Dunstan, the Joe Rogan of Rugby Union Podcasting, the Dame of the Realm, Sarah Cox, and our special guest, Sam Peters. This week, on the field, the Chiefs are into the quarterfinals of the European Champions Cup. The local leagues have been decided. Have Taunton got a great escape in them? Off the field, our special guest, Sam Peters, author of Concussed, a very important conversation. And then in the bin, the first conviction for referee abuse. It's all going down today.
Two locks and a cox.
From Devon's Radio X.
Can I say welcome to Sam, our guest, this afternoon?
You can say that. Hello, welcome. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on. So I've explained the format. We're going to have a little bit about the local rugby, but then I want to have a deep dive into your book. And I think it's a very important conversation. And I'm certainly, my opinion's been changed having done some research around the topic. But we'll get into that in a moment. Yes, everyone happy with that?
I'm very happy. I also, Joe Rogan's great. I love his garage. My garage is quite impressive. His garage is ridiculous.
But who was talking about your extension the other day? Was it you?
On the Tribe Talking.
The
yeah.
Tribe Talking, that yeah. was it. You're talking about on his what? Extension. On Tribe Talking, wait. What? You actually, I've got bone to pick with you.
I had the opportunity to throw you under a bus, and I didn't, Ian. I defended you with my life.
Thank you. I don't listen to it.
I was like Will Skelton playing for La Rochelle where that bloke got knocked out.
Yes.
I leant over your body. I was like, they were like kick the corpse. I was like, no, I will defend him.
I will defend my friend.
Exactly.
He cheated on us, basically. Oh, he cheated on us and went on another podcast.
Good,
yeah, you talk, you got, you gave me a load of I'm not allowed to swear. You gave me a load of stuff for being on that, so you can have some back.
I did last week. I did one called Fibre News. It's available on YouTube. It's all about internet connectivity.
On my chinterweb.
I talked about a product you used to sell when you worked at KCON on Eclipse.
Oh, my God, yeah. That was a long time ago, yeah.
It was, yeah.
I'm old
right,
now.
So,
I got a joke.
Oh, God, what, hang on it. Cox, you got a joke?
Yeah, well, it's like a little riddle. Sam, you can join in on this as well. There are 48 cows in the field and 28 chickens. Oh no, I've forgotten it.
Should we edit
how
this
many
out?
Legs there are? Or how no. many chickens there are?
Come back to me. I'll come back.
It doesn't do anything.
I was practicing chicken, this morning.
Another like wow chicken wow wow or cow chicken cow cow. Is that what it is? It is, isn't it? Cow okay. chicken cow cow.
Right.
So, oh no! Right, hang on. I'll have
so
to text
Cox,
the other half.
Cox is just smashing the desk and getting it all wrong. Okay, so let's go to the European quarterfinal. Exeter Chiefs versus Bath.
Well, can we say hi to Sam first properly?
So, yeah,
you did.
We did. I did. But yeah. would you like to say
you
hi
were
again?
You were playing on your phone. That's why.
I wasn't.
You're looking at RDF televisions.
It's RFU, actually. I was looking up about the 5th, 6th and 7th officials.
Okay. Oh, right, sorry. So, right, I've ruined everything with my joke and I didn't get through
okay,
the whole thing.
So we've had a really tight introduction and the new pair have just been stupid. I'm now going to get down to Rugby Union.
Sorry.
Exeter Chiefs played in the round of 16 in Europe against Bath. Bath had a glittering team and Exeter Chiefs vanquished them and are now into the quarterfinals playing Toulouse at the Stade Ernest Wallon. Who was at the game? Anyone got any comments?
I was at the game. It was amazing. 15,000 people. What an amazing atmosphere. Really torn slightly. It was 15 minutes into the game, wasn't it? It was like, oh, really don't like seeing, you know, any rugby player go off that soon into the game. And then I went, it's Finn Russell. And then I felt really torn about feeling bad, not feeling bad, knowing that that was going to massively change the game for them.
And Cameron Redpath.
Yes.
I've remembered my joke.
Right, your joke's coming later now, Cox. This is called the teaser. If you want to hear Sarah's joke, you've got to listen to the end of the show.
Chris, could I just say, in 20 years of journalism, I've never used the word vanquished. How do you vanquish someone?
You beat them.
You just win.
Yeah, we just win. I just like to be pompous with my words.
It's word salad.
If you spend some more time with Chris, you're like, we have temporal bias. We have all sorts of words.
He used that in Costa earlier on.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Did you get the full Chris Bentley experience?
Well, it's temporal bias. It's the full experience.
I just happen to have a degree in philosophy. I like to use people. Chiefs won the game through, I would say, huge attritional performance, fitter than Bath. Bit of fortune with Finn Russell getting taken off. Bit of fortune with Cameron Redpath. Ben Spencer ended up at 10. Chiefs were on 70-odd% possession. And the game changer was Faye Wabosu.
Holy guacamole.
He made it. The after contact meters he made were phenomenal. Mm. I think actually what the game was, it was that first sort of 20 minutes. We had four tries or four attempts at scoring a try in their five, and we failed all four times. So I was like, oh, this is looking really bad. And then they scored the first time they came into our sort of 22, into our red zone. But actually, the attritional damage
that our
forwards put onto their forwards and onto them as a team defending constantly right on the line for their lives was essentially where the game was sort of won, I think.
Yeah, I'd tend to go with that. And I had a chat with Ali Hefa after the game, and he was very much of opinion we landed the body blows, we knew we were fitter, we knew if we kept going for it rather than build the score, we just had to keep landing body blows, they'd cave in, and they did.
I spoke to him after the game, but that conversation was sponsored by Guinness, so I can't remember any of it.
And then very, very quickly, we'll look. So Chiefs are playing Toulouse. What do you reckon?
Oh. It's a tough ask.
If there's one team that could be a mismatch for Toulouse, it's Exeter Chiefs. That we just keep the ball, but we starve them of possession.
There, isn't he?
Well, we've got 100% success rate against them so far.
Yeah, that's true.
Really?
Yeah, played them once, beaten them once.
Yeah, right. Okay.
We've never been there.
Mm-hmm.
This is our first trip.
It's a hell of a place. You've got to be ready for it.
Oh, God, yeah. But I don't know. It's the beauty of sport. I mean, on paper, Toulouse win comfortably, but you just think if Chiefs can be nuggety and we get, you know, multiple carries into them, you make Miafu fall over, stand up. You never know.
Yeah, and plus they can't use rolling subs like they do in their top 14 games. Nope. So these guys, the big units, have got to do their thing.
Yeah, so we shall see. Okay, everyone happy with Chiefs? Can we move on to local rugby?
That's a quick summary for what was a massive game. But
yeah, exactly. Okay.
I've got Sam, and I really want to have this conversation.
We're not going to talk about any other games in the EPCR competition. Oh, we'll keep moving on.
No, hang on. Other games in the EPCR. There was a massive game at Loftus-Versfeld, wasn't there, Coxie?
Oh, God. Yes.
How was the altitude?
Oh, mate. I put player cam. I was in hospitality. I put player cam on Coxie. I was watching her. She was sucking diesel up and down. And then on like 65 minutes, there was an intercept. The boy ran the length. And I watched Luke Pierce.
Yeah, it wasn't your side, was it? It was the other side.
No, it was right down the middle, thankfully.
Luke Pierce genuinely had to have a word with himself as he was chasing.
And his head starts wobbling when it gets really hot. Honestly, the lungs language? Were fine. So it's really weird. The lungs were fine. It was just my legs started to give up. And I was like, why am I getting slower? And I looked across at Adam Leal on the other side, and the same thing was happening to him. So I thought, it's not just me. But we were burning in the sun. Leon were dead on their feet as well.
What were the logistics for your trip? Because was it like in and out? Or
yeah,
how did it go?
I had a really tight turnaround. So I went, I left on the Wednesday, landed on the Thursday evening, and then left on the Saturday evening and got home on the Sunday evening.
And you went via Dubai, didn't you?
Yeah, I went via Dubai, which is, I think the logistics for the balls coming up to Northampton is causing a bit of a problem.
Oh,
at the
have
moment.
You seen it? It's horrendous. They've split them into four groups.
Yeah, because they couldn't get them all on the plane.
And they're all going to be together in like 2 days' time or something ridiculous.
That's it. Yeah, 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 yeah. Because like some of them, I think, are going. I think there's a few going direct. There's some going through Dubai. There's some going through Frankfurt.
The South African Rugby Union have actually put a press release out saying we've done our best.
The direct flight is the best. I've been via Dubai twice to South Africa for a really good reason.
Yeah.
It was a lot cheaper.
Yeah, no, it is. Like, to go through Dubai is... But you go the wrong... Almost like the wrong direction to come back on yourself to go down. And it's brutal. Like, it takes a long time. So I feel for them a little bit.
It's a 2 8-hour flights, isn't it, essentially?
Essentially, yeah.
But according to the South African Rugby Union, they're averaging £4,500 per player to get them, and members of management staff to get them from South Africa to the UK.
Per player?
Yeah.
That's crazy. That's business class.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
They've all found business class.
Oh, that's fine. Well, that's honestly business class.
So people take the mick, especially you two, about business class. It makes a huge difference at the other end because you can actually lie down and you can get some sleep. Whereas if you're the economy side of stuff, you're upright, you wake up and your head is now in your lap and you've got to now upright yourself. Honestly, it makes a huge difference.
Well, believe me, if somebody else was paying, I would be business class. Or first class, without doubt. It was me paying.
I can't now. I've got a lovely extension on the back of my house.
Okay, so
Chris is not impressed.
No, I want to drive on to local
Enough
rugby.
Enough of your guff.
I want to drive on to local rugby.
Right,
so Plymouth Albion, Kingmakers in National One. They defeated Rams, so Chinner only need 3 points from their final two games. So
they've only got two games left, though.
There's two games left in National One. So Chinner, I've got Birmingham Moseley this weekend. Moseley will try and upset the apple cart and take it to the last week.
Do you remember when Birmingham Moseley were in the Championship?
I used to play against them all the time.
Yeah, I remember going watching them.
Andy Hall just hosted a big Doddy Weir fundraiser in Hong Kong, and I commented, "Hey, Andy, do you remember when me and you used to fight at Billesley Common?"
That's amazing.
And we did as well.
I mean, there were Pertemp Bees as well, were
yes,
they?
Yes, yes, Pertemp Bees.
They were in the same area.
Yeah.
So, oh, showing your age. Yeah, and
Taunton Titans.
Taunton Titans, could they hang in?
It's mate. I texted Yappy. I said, "Mate, are you going to do the Great Escape?" He needs to get a load of slabs of beer and put them in the changing room and say, "Right, lads, we're going to do the Great Escape. Then we're going to do the Great Escape." As motivation for them to stay.
Oh yeah,
up.
You went. Who was talking about the Crate Escape? Was that you on your Tribe podcast again?
I've done it.
A Crate Escape.
What is this? Explain the Crate Escape.
When we did it in Exmouth was when certain Richard Caddywood was going off to join the Marines in Afghanistan. So we turned the change room into a beach. Everyone put two bags of sand in, and we filled the changing room with sand. We then filled the door up with crates of beer, and no one could leave until we drank all the beer, so we could actually get out the door. And you couldn't go for wheeze or anything else like that.
It's the Crate Escape.
Wow. Yeah.
So you fill the doorway with slabs of beer and you cannot leave until the beer is
gone. Have you ever
seen
cats in a litter tray? Yeah, very similar to that.
Oh, good God.
When you said we can go for wheeze and stuff like that.
Yeah, I was like, oh, my goodness.
Oh, wow. Some things are best left to the imagination, or probably made much worse by people's imagination. And that's just because they're sick.
And moving on to other local teams, Ian, you've got a list of teams that have won leagues.
Yeah, so Devonport Services done really well. They've been strong all season, and that's really good to see that because they've come up through the leagues over the last few years.
They've got a real challenge because they're a naval team, so they don't pay players.
There used to be a lot of services people.
But their system is they don't pay.
Services. No.
And now they're into the national leagues. It's whether they're going to have to start remunerating
it's
the players.
It's going to be hard work, that is. Especially when you've got Plymouth on your doorstep.
Plymouth is a literal stone's throw away.
Don't pay. I used to love playing.
It is just the bottom of the hill, isn't it?
Devonport Service is one of my favourite places to go and play because you felt like you were in a proper stadium.
I did. No, I did one of my first ever games there, refereeing. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
First, yeah.
Who else has won leagues, Ian?
Sidmouth.
Yep.
They've gone flying up through, and Tiverton.
Get on. And Dan Williams at Torquay, they finished second. He's come in as head coach. He was former Gloucester, he's got a chocolate shoulder, but he's done a bit for them, done one hell of a job here. Sam also has a chocolate shoulder. We'll get to that in a moment.
And that's really good because Torquay had sort of dropped down to Exmouth Second Team League with Withycombe and all of those. And they shouldn't be there. They're such a great rugby club. I mean, you know, back in the day, they used to play Chiefs and they were a real strong, strong team, weren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but this comes back to me. I want Devon rugby to be something very important, and you need the clubs to be thriving, and then they can do well for Devon, and then Devon can go well to the county champs, and we'd all be proud about it. And those outside the elite tier can have something to look forward to.
Thriving little hub of rugby at the moment, haven't we, in Devon?
So it's Devon Cup now for everything. I mean, the weather's called so many games off. It's just
hang on, guys. Just so everyone's aware, we're listening on Devon's Radio X. I just wanted to put that one in there.
Whee.
Incidentally, this weekend, if you are not going to the Stad Arnest while on to watch the Exeter Chiefs, do make your way up to Veritas Park. Go and support Tony Yap's Taunton Titans. They're playing Cinderford in they're playing a big game, and you need to go and support
them.
Good
research, Chris.
Yeah, I just know that Veritas Park, and I thought it was Cinderford. We're going to find out, and we'll come back to
Brad
you.
Rugby God is...
Brad's going to find out for us.
Frantically typing.
That will be a mega game for Taunton Titans in their battle to stay in the National Leagues. And they are playing against, it's Cinderford. It's Cinderford,
well,
I got it right.
There you go.
Thank you.
Back yourself, love.
And then they're away to Blackheath if they win that to stay in the league.
Blackheath, oof, that'll be a toughie. That'll be a real toughie.
But they could do it. If they beat Cinderford, I think that puts Cinderford into the relegation.
Have you ever
mix.
Been to Cinderford's pitch?
Yes, up on top of a hill.
On top of a hill behind Co-op.
Yep.
Just appears from nowhere. And you're
Cinderford is very much like Wharfdale. Like somebody has to go out and blow the horn and the players come from all parts. Wharfdale is the best for that. Wharfdale, there is nothing. You're in the middle of nowhere and then someone goes and all these farmers and people come along and throw on their green. Like the Vivian family had eight brothers all play for the same team.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It is very special, Wharfdale. Anyway, right. We have a special guest with us today and I'm really keen to have this conversation. Sam Peters has written the book Concussed. Let me get the...
Let us get his notes.
Sports uncomfortable
you got
truth.
That right. Well done.
Sports uncomfortable truth. Stephen Jones, Sam Peters has put a truly magnificent campaign on concussion in rugby. Sport will be safer because of it. Welcome, Sam.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, I mean, I genuinely don't know where to start with this. I'd like to sort of hand it to you and say, do you want to give us a pricey of where you're at, and then we can sort of riff
around. Well, let's
it.
Get a bit of background of Sam. Who are you? Where'd you come from? Let's start.
Hello,
there.
My name's Sam Peters, and I have a chocolate shoulder. Chris,
you told me.
I mean, I'm just interested that there are some like words associated with injuries that
yes.
always seem to be food related.
So, yeah.
Poppadom fingers in cricket, and you've got a spiral fracture of your finger.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I'm just thinking maybe in scrambled brain, I've just realised where the idea
yeah.
of scrambled brain. So it's egg, isn't it?
Yeah.
It looks like egg.
Well, the Exeter Chiefs club captain's nickname is Egg, and when he was concussed, they called him scrambled egg.
There we go.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
That's quite funny. It's not funny, but it is funny.
It's exactly that's. But in answer to your question, Coxie, my name is Sam Peters. Yes. I think we've established that, yep. haven't we? But I was the rugby correspondent at the Mail on Sunday for 6 years. Latterly, I was at the Sunday Times. But I grew up playing rugby. Played for Richmond, played for Edinburgh University, got injured, bust my shoulder, was in the army for a short period of time. I'm sorry about that, Ian.
It was a year, I saw.
One year, exactly.
Dirty old Pongo.
Played some rugby for the army, or for the infantry rather than the army itself, but got pretty mashed up playing. So ended up being a journalist, which is probably the only thing that's more stupid than actually being a rugby player.
No, there's one thing.
Oh, yes,
becoming
you're right.
a referee.
Fair point.
Well, you were cannon fodder for a while, so that's good.
Exactly. But yeah, I covered rugby for 20 years, used to cover 50 games a season, ended up, well, quite quickly got on the national beat, so I was covering England mainly. Did some fantastic tours, did a couple of World Cups, including the 2007 World Cup.
I saw the 2007 one.
You did.
I saw it when I was stalking you.
I thought I remembered you.
Yeah. Actually, I was in Marseille for the 2007 World Cup.
That God,
was
don't start me off on this again.
It was a cracker. First game of
did
rugby
you take
I'd ever taken my wife to. No, we flew.
Business class?
No, he doesn't pay for business class. He's too cheap.
He was business. His wife was at the back.
Yeah. he sent a champagne down okay. every now and again.
So actually, we're covering the Rugby World Cup.
So I knew the culture of rugby. I played it, I lived it, I breathed it, everything. You know, it was my life growing up. You know, my dad was played rugby, captained England student, used to play for a club called Old Madonians, which is now Chiswick Rugby Club. Actually went blind in one eye, partially blind in one eye because he'd had so many knocks to the head, which I didn't sort of really think much about. It certainly didn't stop him from encouraging me and my brother to play. I was at school, left school in 95, just as the game went professional. I was playing for Richmond. And I was playing 10, reasonable chance of getting the first team, I think. And then they brought in a guy called Adrian Davis, a player called Earl Varr. Basically, overnight, the game went professional. Loads of money came into Richmond. I had no chance of getting in the first 15. Then I started getting injured the whole time. And as I say, ended up going into journalism. And around sort of early 2000s, 2003, when I got on the national beat, I was sort of regularly covering Premiership rugby. And basically was just astonished at the extent of the injuries, the volume of injuries, the severity of the injuries. It wasn't really a game that I recognised from growing up. And I started writing about it. I pretty quickly worked out that people didn't like me writing about it because it wasn't the presentation that the marketing guys wanted. And, you know, it felt to me that there was this sort of tension between being a journalist or being a sort of extension of the PR department of the RFU or the clubs, because the game was trying to get off the ground commercially. It was professional, newly professional. Everyone wanted to say, this is an amazing game, this is an amazing sport, which I totally believe it is, by the way. But I just felt it was getting taken down a path which I was really surprised about and concerned about. And a lot of my mates had gone professional. I was hearing lots of stories within the dressing room, which were quite alarming. Pretty extreme practice going on. I've been really interested in the Lance Armstrong and also the drug taking in cycling culture that could basically close off stories or truth from coming out. And concussion was something that I was kind of aware with because I'd had a few playing, but I'd always played a few days later, magic sponge, all that, everything fixes itself. And as time went on covering injuries, I started to look at concussions and the 2007 World Cup, which I was at the game, England-Tonga, where Lewis Moody was knocked out twice in the same game. And he wasn't just a bit kind of scrambled, as we've used that analogy. He was completely unconscious. but played on. And that to me just didn't feel good. But I pushed back against a few people and said, you know, is that right? Is that okay? You know, and all the people, medics, doctors, coaches, players were all saying, yeah, it's complete. Of course, it's fine. He's got the best care you could possibly have. Everything's fine. And I guess just over time, I just felt this isn't fine. It's ridiculous that people are being knocked out. In boxing, you'd end a fight. Why were rugby players different? So I kept writing about it. And in 2005, I've become the rugby correspondent of the Mail on Sunday. And I chose to use the platform to launch a campaign to say we need to change the way that concussions are handled in professional rugby. It's getting out of hand. The numbers, the data that the RFU held, which not many of us were looking at, but I'm sort of a bit weirdly data-y obsessed. And I was looking at the trajectory of concussion and just seeing what I was seeing with my own eyes and going, look, we've got a problem here. Are we going to deal with it or are we going to pretend it's not there? And I made quite a few enemies, it's fair to say.
I was going to say, I think you're a public enemy number one.
Yes, thank you.
Where are we on that scale now, do you think?
I don't know, I've blocked everyone.
Not that everybody hates you. Yeah. Where are we on the scale of everyone ignoring what's going on and actually buying into this?
I think game-wide, like, so much further down the track than we were 10, 12 years ago. Since the book's come out, you know, I was lucky, you know, I was shortlisted for the William Hill Sports Book of the Year recently, which was amazing for me personally, but much more importantly, I've started speaking to people outside of professional rugby because it is a bubble, as Coxie would agree, I'm sure. You know, you don't really hear a lot of what's going on outside. You think that's just what it is. It's normal. I've gone to loads of schools and it's really evident to me that there is a massive piece of work that's gone on and just the awareness is way, way better than it ever has been. And
schools, if in doubt, sit them out.
Yeah, sort of. Absolutely. And it's that's massively encouraging for me. It's been a really positive experience since the book's come out because, as I say, I've stepped away from the professional game. Mm. And I'm speaking to lots of people who are going, we share your concerns. You know, the game is very, very, very different to what it was 20 years ago, like really very different. And all I've tried to do is present a different picture or a different narrative for rugby, which is not about collisions all the time. It's not about, and you talk about Toulouse, obviously, but one of the really interesting, exciting things that I've been introduced to is the Villepreux Plaisir de Mouvement style of coaching, which a lot of the schools are looking at now and looking at that old idea of attacking space rather than attacking the player, carrying for space.
Space, not faces, or something like that?
Yeah. Branches, not trees.
Yeah. So it's a tough subject, and it is. It's a really tricky one because so much of the stuff that I loved about rugby and still love about rugby is the off-the-pitch stuff, the fun, the games, the culture, the camaraderie that you get from rugby. I'm a massive, massive rugby fan, but I've obviously written about something that is really quite serious, and it's sort of like letting the air out of a balloon sort of talking about it,
but you have to be, unfortunately for people to listen, you have to be a bit extremist. So as you've been pulling those needles out your voodoo doll that people have been putting in there, that's how you've got to go to get a point, because if you go in softly on a point, no one will ever get you. So I've got really strong opinions, which really annoys people, but they actually know about them. Whereas if you're just sort of there not talking about it, so a lot of people would say you don't really love rugby, do you? You're just obsessed with concussion.
And that's fine. And anyone who knows me, and hopefully the book has enabled me to present, you know, how much of my life has been absorbed by rugby. You don't end up, believe it or not, becoming a correspondent on a national newspaper covering rugby if it's not absolutely in your blood. So everything I've done has been for me because I love the sport and I'm concerned about the direction of travel it's gone on. And to me, I hope, if once people have read the book, they'll recognise it's not the sport, the game itself, that I've been going after. It's been the administrators and some of the commercially conflicted interests that have taken it down a path which I think has been pretty dangerous.
Yeah, because Stuart Barnes this week wrote, didn't he, Bordeaux's monster props prove it's time to ban non-injury replacements.
Mm. Yeah, well, before we sort of start looking at the specifics, I'd like to sort of, because I used to be really against you for precisely the point Ian made, that you had to be quite provocative in some of the language you've used, whereas I've gone through a position now where I think I'm actually on side with you entirely. How was it for you in the beginning when you first started to say, look, because like you say, we've started today, we've been laughing and joking, and almost you've come in and you've said this, and now but we have to be serious, because I mean, we can laugh and joke, and I've mentioned to you that one of my mentors died of motor neurons disease, one of my coaches had a neurological issue that ended his life. Like, this is a real thing.
And it's your favourite motto,
What?
The risk is the reward.
Oh, the risk is the reward. I do maintain that. But I'd like to understand, in the first instance, how you dealt with so many people shouting in your face in a much more coarse parlance, go away.
Shut up. Yeah. It was weird. Like, I mean, you know, again, you don't get into those positions without blowing a bit of wind up myself, I'm sorry, without being able to communicate well with people. You can socialise well. Mm-hmm. Like, all the rugby journalists are my mates. I've got, you know, the Rugby Writers Club, I'm a member of that club. You know, I got on with a lot of people. I'm a sociable person.
Yeah.
But I saw this story and I decided, you know, rather than, what am I, a rugby fan or am I a journalist? And where's the story? And to me, the story was so obviously concussion, and the way that it was changing, and the volume, the number of concussions that were happening, and that was as a direct result of the game going professional. And then this other conflict of interest, which was because the game was professional, the players were much more prepared to take extreme risks. Mm-hmm. The doctors were conflicted.
Like what?
Like playing on after they'd been knocked completely unconscious twice in the same game. And I also, Bloodgate was a really big one for me because, and I covered a lot of Quins around that time.
It's something that should be said. It wasn't just Quins that did this.
Oh, well, and that's absolutely what Dean Richards said to me.
Lots of other clubs did exactly the same thing and
they just didn't get caught.
Yeah.
Correct.
Well,
correct. This is rugby union in essence. We all try and work around the laws as best we can without getting caught. He got caught, and there was an issue with me in that lots of people within the game should have said, well, actually, we've all been cheating like this, and instead he just got thrown under the bus and there was sanctimony and he's terrible.
Yeah.
Well, that's what you do, just to make yourself feel justified.
Yeah, but these are uncomfortable truths. There's truths you can handle and there's uncomfortable truths.
There you go.
This is another one. So carry on.
Dean was, you know, a big character, to say the least, and I looked at what played out in that Bloodgate, and I don't know if I need to explain the background to it, but obviously rugby fans listening to this will understand it.
And if they're not, just Google Bloodgate.
Yeah, Google Bloodgate. And that, to me, showed that if a culture wasn't right, you could basically have staff, employees, in this case a female doctor, who felt under so much pressure that they were going to commit basically a pretty questionable act that was essentially compromising their integrity and compromising the health of the players who they were meant to be looking after in order to service the employer, which is the club. It's a really conflicted position. And so that, to me, also led me to believe that if they were prepared to literally use a scalpel in a player's mouth to fake an injury, what else would they cover up? And, yeah, I was seeing all these concussions happening all the time, and I was being told there's nothing to see here, there's no problem. But going back to your question of what was it like to basically be partially ostracised, and I don't want to overdo, you know, how, like, a lot of people said I was doing the right thing.
The only parallel I can draw is David Walsh with his quest to uncover the drug taking in cycling with Lance Armstrong, and he was vilified and pilloried and all sorts. And now he's come through and said, well, I was right.
Yeah.
But I needed to be strong through this, because there is a process where everybody... I love rugby union. You can't say anything bad about rugby union.
Exactly.
It's my game.
Exactly.
There's so much that matters to me in this game.
And it's about, to me, it was about being like a critical supporter, a supporter. But, so, you know, it's like I support Tottenham for my sins, you know, but it doesn't stop me from off as well. But observing that there's a problem we need to fix. You know, I had some, you remember the Steve Diamond incident that I massively, you know, basically got offered outside by Steve Diamond.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, but that was you. I remember that.
That was me. So, you know, but that was all part of me.
Hang on, let's rewind here. What was the... give a little bit of detail on this.
Okay, if you want to Google Bloodgate, then Google Sam Peters, Steve Diamond instead.
You called him out on some of his behaviours, he just decided he was going to challenge you to a fight.
I called him out on a number of player welfare issues, which resulted in me writing a pretty provocative article, but it was also an article that was basically just factual, listing his misdemeanours. I wrote a pretty provocative article. I then bumped into Steve, let's say, bumped into. I was at Gloucester Sale around Christmas 2018, I'm going to say. It might have been 2018. And he offered me outside, basically. And I said yes, because I thought if he chins me, it's going to be a good story. And if he doesn't, then it's going to be a good story anyway.
Yeah.
And
What did you call him out on then? Give some of the detail.
Okay, so
that.
Ben Curry, I'd covered a game at Salford a few weeks before, and I could hear him again. Is this a particularly professional thing for the sport to do? But they sit the coaches sometimes, pretty much next door to the press.
Yeah.
So I could hear everything he was saying, And he was just basically, Ben Curry went down, he had a neck injury, suspected concussion, and Diamond was saying, just get him back on the pitch, get him back on the pitch, dictating to the doctors what was being, what should happen, which to me was insane. Like, why could a coach make those calls or put pressure on? What did it have to do with it? There were incidents where he talked about, I think he quoted as saying, all you need now is a slap on the head in rugby and you're off for 10 minutes. He verbally abused various people, which I'd witnessed, and I wrote about it. As a rugby journalist, you are kind of in a little world again. Like, you go back to the same well for information all the time. You have to be very careful who you alienate or who you upset. Most people have chosen not to go head to head with Steve Diamond, and I just thought, well,
he's tough bloke. I played against him. He's really? Hard.
He's probably like Ventnor in that situation, isn't he? With the best interviewer of all times.
Oh, yeah. You
annoy Diamond, you're gonna get the same thing.
Well, I definitely annoyed Diamond, and yeah, we went up into the sort of corridors of Kingsholm, and it got pretty fruity. You know, he didn't chin me, but he definitely wanted to.
Yeah.
And it made the back pages for about 4 or 5 days, which got a bit boring. But I write about all that in the book. But looking in isolation, a lot of people thought it was a complete muppet, I'm sure.
But this is the challenge, and that almost encapsulates what it is the machismo that used to exist in rugby union of, you know, pain is
weakness leaving the body.
There you go. Going from that to going, actually, this is now something that I need to address. And I feel culturally there has been a shift away from the old school macho of rugby union of 15 years ago that I was raised in. You were raised in. That, a lot of people listening, that was, you know, pain is weakness leaving in the body and all this sort of palaver, and pain is motivation. Well, actually, no. Pain is your body saying there's something wrong. Now, sometimes you can crack on through whatever it may be. But with your head, absolutely categorically, we're now seeing that if you do crack on, you're going to have a very high risk of repercussions later in your life.
Yeah, and I think as the game was getting more and more professional, I think you were getting all this data, you were getting much more information, and the RFU had all this injury data, which they'd done really well to actually kind of drive that through, and I commend them in the book for the work they did on that. So the clubs and the RFU had this injury data, which never previously existed. On the one hand, they were saying everything we do is evidence-based, we are being as scientific and as professional as possible. But they were ignoring this data that was showing that the concussions were getting worse and worse and worse. And then double down on that, the fact that in the NFL, there was $765 million lawsuit paid out in 2013 to ex-players who were suffering neurodegenerative problems linked to repetitive head injury. And I was
So now they've done that in the NFL. Mm. Is there anything in place there, or have they just made the game such that there's no further payouts going to happen if somebody has a neurodegenerative problem? Because I'm going to ask stupid... They're not stupid questions. Yeah. There's never a stupid question.
No, it's not capped. So it's there could be more payouts. Right. But I think where it's the negligence issue that is what they're focused on.
McDonald's writing on coffee, the liquid in this cup could be hot.
Yeah, well, yes, okay. I mean, that's the extreme, yeah.
But that's what it is. Yeah, so they've made this agreement with all those players and almost the people that do it now.
Yeah.
Not the risk is the reward, but there's much more education around it.
But moving on, there is no doubt the professional game, there is a greater chance of neurological damage if you play professionally. What are we looking at?
Well, you're saying that, but the RFU aren't saying that.
Okay.
You know, I mean, Bill Sweeney isn't saying that. There's no admission that there's a link between the two, which is...
Well, they can't at the moment because there's this court case. Yeah. But the issue for me is, right, I hope there aren't any bad actors. There's an inference that you're bringing the people who have seen detail and have not shared detail.
Not only that, but it was also completely misrepresented previous research, previous science. And again, I talk about it in the book. There's a guy called Paul McCrory in Australia. He has been found guilty of plagiarism on an epic scale, basically, and he was the lead of a thing called the Concussion in Sports Group, still very influential, but he's a fraud, and he led the conversation, basically. He led the sport. He was advising multiple sports, including at times rugby union. He worked on papers which have been co-authored by the RFU's head of medicine, and he is a proven fraud. He described the NFL case as a hoo-ha going on in NFL, and he's basically spent most of his life denying that there's a long-term risk associated with repetitive head injuries.
So there's a lot of people listening to this podcast that are thinking, oh my God, I never want to play rugby again. Where can we go now with the game at community level where people are nowhere near as high-powered as... Because one of the big things for me is, I think the high-powered pros, absolutely, if you've got a 19 stone person running flat out into a 19 stone person, things are going to go wrong. But at community level, a 19 stone person is a completely different 19 stone because they're more likely going to be like me and Ian. We're not going to be able to generate the forces.
Like a melted candle.
Yeah. Is there a similar level of risk in community rugby, or is it more about practices that people have to have around themselves? So if you take the knock, just take 6 weeks off.
Exactly. I mean, and this has been this tension, that this sort of conflict that I've had within myself for years, is that by writing about this, is it going to detrimentally impact the amount of people who play the game?
Yeah.
My argument was always the thing that's going to detrimentally impact the amount of people that play the game is if they see England players being knocked out repeatedly and being allowed to play on. If I was a parent, which I am now, I wasn't then, I was saying I wouldn't want my kids playing like a game like that.
Yeah.
Whereas on the other hand, I massively loved playing rugby and I put so much value on it, and I absolutely would recommend people should play rugby, but only in the right conditions and the right culture, where you make sure that you don't have coaches who only care about the result. You've got coaches who care about the participants and put their welfare ahead of the result, basically.
Just on that, obviously now we aren't, as far as we're aware, not seeing that now.
Mm-hmm.
So the technology that's in place with Hawkeye, you've got independent match day doctors that do lots and lots of different things, especially on internationals. You've got club doctors, you've got protocols, you've got all the HIA processes and so on and so forth. Where does that leave everything now? Because that's very different to what you're talking about then, is sort of the double Lewis Moody knockout.
Yeah.
You don't, as far as we can see, you don't see that anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Lewis Moody incident would now be an absolute scandal, whereas then in 2007, it was, I mean, I think one of us wrote about a line in the entire match report. It was generally like Lewis Moody, you know, warrior, couple of knocks, carried on, you know, happy days sort of thing. So that piece has been taken care of to a large extent. The piece that I think hasn't been is the volume of games that the guys play. You know, we just talk about World Cup Club Championship or whatever the new term's going to be, but RFU have said New Zealand are going to play at Twickenham in September. There is as many games being played as there's ever been for the players, and I think that exposure is a big, big issue.
So is that what you're starting to unearth again now? Is that you believe from your point of view and what you've seen over the years is that the volume of playing time has increased. So yes, we've got these protocols in place that they are working, and again, as far as we can see, but you're saying now that the issue is that actually the volume of game and the game time that these players are having to go through is now the issue.
And also the amount of contact training that they do. So all the, again, looking at the data, which is the bit that's hard to argue with because that is what it is. There's more injuries in training now than there's ever been. Like the curve again, you know, there's been this sort of historic kind of presentation that training is now super scientific and there's none of that Full Metal Jacket, you know, bone on bone training. The evidence suggests that that's totally untrue. There's
as we know it, man who is now fit, he's joined the England camp.
Yes.
Man who is now broken and will be leaving the England camp.
But that, you know, that again was like, how can the sport be ultra professional but still be absolutely like smash, like players getting injured in training?
But no, can I just on that point, because I've been in obviously with a few clubs and that bone on bone stuff is becoming less and less. You know, and especially more recently, there are a few clubs that pride themselves in the fact that they don't do a lot of bone on bone
during
smart.
The week.
I've seen clubs do things based solely on timings. So the volume of work within that time is reduced because the time has been reduced. I've seen clubs go off GPS metering. So the minute you hit what they're looking for, you get pulled out and that's the end of that. And I've seen lots of different techniques coming in now. So there is this want to keep players on their feet, to keep players sort of away from that injury side of stuff. Yes, you're seeing that data curve, but is that like, how is that matching up? Because in my head at the moment, it's like, I'm surprised by that. I'm surprised by that the injuries are coming in training. Is that almost off the back of the volume of playing time on weekends and things like that is then sort of manifesting itself in training because bodies are tired?
I mean, you just used exactly the word. They're tired. The guys are knackered, basically. You know, they're playing way too much rugby. You know, the top guys, if you look at the NFL, which And since 2013, when that legal case happened, there's lots and lots of, you know, crying and people, the game's going to go soft. Like, we're not, this is not going to be the game that we once knew. The NFL's as tough and as physical as it's ever been, even though they've brought in a load of protocols like around training. So really strict limits on contact training during a season. Basically, there is none during the 16-match NFL season. Reduction, like where the tackle can be made. It's about looking at the science, looking at the data, and then acting accordingly. And there's some really easy wins that can be done in rugby union, which would basically enable the players to, their bodies to be peak physical condition. They play less rugby. You've got more of the top guys fit all the time. So for the big matches, they're more marketable games. So I've argued for a long time we should play less rugby in front of bigger crowds, bigger stadiums, better, more of the top guys fit all the time.
So like the NFL. And move,
yeah, and yeah. I think there's this sort of weird mentality in rugby union, which is because it is essentially a niche sport, which it always will be in England and Britain and the world, despite this obsession with growing it globally. Like, it's always going to be outperformed.
The grow the game rhetoric. Yeah. I'm like, why?
Yeah.
Why can't we be satisfied with the people that enjoy the game, that want to watch this game? Why do we have to keep changing the laws and infuse more people?
Yeah.
No, this is a great game. Let's keep it as it is. And if you don't like it, you don't have to watch it. That's cool.
Because when you die, ultimately, out of the game, there's nothing left. The reality is, Chris, that at the moment, we have got this generation of people that are the stalwarts of rugby. Mm-hmm. And that's like you guys, us in the room. The next generation coming through, so like your son, like your daughter, are not interested. Mm. They're not getting in the engagement. They can't stop people picking up phones throughout games. They can't keep people engaged. So if you don't change something and you don't have more people and grow the game, there will be no game. It will categorically die on
itself.
I think
the game will exist. I just don't think it might be as ludicrous as trying to ship a team from South Africa to England on a five-day turnaround because you're trying to make money.
Don't get me wrong. Like, I see those bits, definitely. But there is an element.
I think the game will exist. It might not be as professional as it is, but perhaps hearing about when you've got these huge people colliding with each other, maybe that ain't a bad thing. If you, I love rugby union,
but then it's people's livelihoods are gone.
Well, they'll find another job. If it means we don't have anybody with a neurological problem, but if you're going to say their jobs are gone, you introduce the binary. I'm quite happy to be more shades of grey with this. But
it's not binary.
I think we've got to have this clumsy debate because we need. I think this is the next evolution of where we're going.
Because
we all care about rugby union.
Yeah.
We all want the game to persist. We all want to, you know, there's so much I've taken from this game that I want to give back to it every which way. And I'm really happy to be having this conversation now and learning a bit and seeing that there is perhaps a bit of merit in this court case. I still feel that seems statistically it's a lot worse if you played in Wales than anywhere else, which would suggest there's a few Welsh boys that are swinging the lead a bit. But irrespective of, we've got to have this conversation. We've got to look at the outcomes. We're talking a lot about the elite game. I'd like to just move slightly across.
I've just got one more question. Sorry. I think this is relevant. So you say about volumes of games and things like that. Mm. Has there ever been a comparison between Northern Hemisphere rugby and Southern Hemisphere rugby? Because as far as I understand it, they play a lot less rugby in the Southern Hemisphere over different time periods to what we do. They don't have your European competitions, like ignoring South Africa and that stuff at the moment. But, you know, you look at your Super Rugbys and things like that, they play it over a very short period of time. Mm. Has there ever been a comparison of data from what happens in the Premiership and the volume of injuries over those years or over that subsequent year versus what happens in a Southern Hemisphere Super Rugby environment and how, again, the volume of games? Because if you've got injuries are like for like, then it's not volume of the game, is it? Because they're playing less.
All I was obviously covering England and covering English club rugby, I was just comparing it in the Northern Hemisphere, the number of injuries that England were constantly getting. You go into every single big tournament and it was the story was England injuries. It's still basically the same. The number of injuries that the England players were suffering was absolutely higher than other comparable European teams. I mean, you look at Ireland now, the structure of the competition of the game in Ireland is much more sort of pyramid structure. There's less tension between provincial and national. It's all basically channeling up. And same, you go to Australia, New Zealand, everything's going up towards the national team, basically. So direct like-for-like comparison, very difficult, but absolutely there's evidence to show that England players got more injuries more frequently, and that the national team was affected. Yeah.
Versus, because also, if you the comparison of the French league, the French play probably just as much rugby, mm-hmm. if not a little bit
play more.
Again, are they seeing the same things as what happened in England, or are we talking about systems internally?
One thing I will show in, which is anecdotal, is I played professionally in France. They did 2004. There was zero contact in training.
Mm. Yeah,
the French,
yeah.
Like, genuinely, I went as an Englishman and started charging around, smashing people, and they're like, "Whoa, do someone, like, calm down."
Yeah. That's really interesting.
I was being like, it was all, there was no contact in training. And then you warm up like lunatics and not have a fight in the first 5 minutes. Bonkers.
Yeah. But that is pretty smart. Well, I mean, that, and it's actually common sense, but it rugby never used to be about physical training during the week. Like, it was always just turn up Tuesday, Thursday night, you'd smash it around a bit, and then, but it would be like an hour and a half session, wouldn't it, probably? Yeah. And then you go and play on the weekend. So,
but just, is there a comparison between that? So are France seeing the same problem as what England are seeing?
So you'd have to basically speak to a French journalist who's covered the French Rugby Union don't have the same data set that the RFU has. And that's, you know, I do understand where some people within the RFU would say, you know, we're being hoisted by our own petard or whatever the expression is, but because we've got this information, we've got this data, but there's no question that the curve has gone up with concussion, the curve's gone up with severity of injuries, and the curve's gone up with training ground injuries.
And is that across global rugby, or are you just saying it's across English
rugby?
That's
across English rugby.
The interesting point is that it's quite a poignant point, and I think it would be really interesting to see the comparison of others, because yes, the focus is English rugby and the standard of English rugby. But if you're not seeing that in other leagues that have a higher volume of rugby, or if you're seeing the same that have lower volumes of rugby, surely this data is now skewing because you're focusing and pigeonholing yourself just down English rugby.
But there is no other data there, so you can only use the data that's available.
There isn't a New Zealand version of Sam who's stuck his head out and gone, I'm going to do this and I'm going to push
forward. The one thing we are seeing is this: rugby union is the only sport of rugby league rugby as in general is the only sport that's seeing a much higher prevalence of people with neurological conditions.
Don't get me wrong. No, I completely agree with that. But I'm just interested that the data is coming out of England, and England have stuck their hand up and said, we'll capture this data. Mm. I've seen them capture that data
behind the scenes.
They're doing really well.
Yep.
Surely then there is a call for other unions to do exactly the same thing and capture data that is the equivalent, and this might be a world rugby thing, you all capture the same data and then compare it, because at the moment I feel you've only got one data set to work from that isn't...
But it's quite a big data set. And my argument was always, well, what's the point in having this data if you're not going to act on it?
And
if England
sure.
have that data, they should use it and actually be the sort of champions of
100%.
I've got to close it down because we're running long. What I want to do is, we've been speaking about a rarefied air of 2% of rugby players, community rugby. Mm. Where are we at with that?
Well, let's go back to what I was talking about before, which is, I think the awareness is way, way bit greater than it ever was. You know, clearly participation numbers are a struggle. Coxie just alluded to some of the reasons why. I don't think rugby's the only sport which is struggling to get people to play, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I think it's got some unique challenges because of the concussion and the injury narrative. But clearly, lots of sports, apart from football, seem to be struggling to get kids to play. And that's a problem for our society. That's a problem for so many reasons. But I think the community level, I have a lot more confidence that if a player is knocked out or suffers a concussion, they're much more likely to leave the field today than they were 10 years ago. And that is progress.
And the principal thing is, it doesn't really matter. So if you're an elite level player and you're knocked out, well, I got to play, coach, I got to be in the game. Whereas if it's community, look, it doesn't matter if you lose this game.
It does, though. To the players, it does.
Okay.
So I've seen it week in, week out. Some players, people I've played with who've been knocked out, and they want to play again, and the doc's gone, you can't.
Yeah.
They go, I want to. This is a really big game for me. We're short on props or whatever else.
But then you have this nuanced position where you say, well,
you do.
At what point does the... Now that people know...
Yeah.
are we in a position to say, well, we can't play? Or do you say, well, look, if you want to make that decision, you're going to have to lie in this bed in 10 years' time?
Refereeing juniors, and I've said like that, right, he's just had a knock, coach, take him off, coach, taking him off. Dad's on the sideline, yeah. He's ready to go back on now. Yeah. I'm like, not on my pitch, he's not.
Yeah. That's a great point, you know, yeah. And that is a real
and
constant
that's dad.
Challenge.
People that's can't... dad, that's not the coach. Yeah. The coach has accepted my word because I've seen it. Dad's like, oh, he's all right, don't worry about it.
I had it as well. I had it in a game, I won't name the teams, but a guy got clearly knocked out, so he took a knee to the head, just trying to make a tackle, and just as he strikes through, it just hits him in the face. Goes out cold. I see him clearly out cold, and I turn around, I stop the game, and I say no. So by the time the physio has come on, he's turned around and said, he's fine, he's awake. And I said, look, I saw him very clearly knocked out. Now, there are very different protocols in the elite game than there is into the community game, but the physio turned around and said, well, I'll HIA him. I was like, well, you can't HIA him, firstly, because you're not allowed to. And then, all of a sudden, he turns around to me and says, are you questioning my medical? I was like, I'm not questioning anything about your medical qualifications and so on and so forth. The fact of the matter is, I've seen this and I have the power to remove him. And in law, we have the power to remove players off the pitch, regardless of whether that's elite or community. We don't in the elite game because there are so much protocol and people around that. But it's interesting what pressures you get as a referee.
It's a fascinating thing, and I'm really interested to hear that because it's good that you didn't name who that club was, but that's poor from that medic.
This is about 10 years ago.
Yeah,
by the
right.
Way.
But you know, I encountered it. Like, good doctors to me should be like, dare I say, good journalists or good researchers or good anyone. You should have an open mind and be looking for information to gather as much information as you can to make the most informed choice, the most informed decision. And I just felt that in rugby, the doctors were not looking hard enough at the evidence and the information, and that medic and you or physio that you just described should have been going, who else saw what happened, who else, you know, what's the evidence that I can gather to make the best decision for this person.
Yeah, but it was 7-10 at the time. Exactly. And the lad on the floor, no, but this is I've had the same with it, exactly the same. And the guy, he's like, well, I'm a lead paramedic and this, I'm like, I don't care if you're Imard Bruce Lee on my pitch, he's not coming back on.
But that takes some leadership to do that, what you've just described. Like, you need to be quite brave to stand up in those positions.
I think the big thing is the tide is turning. It's thanks to some of the work you've done, Sam. So
thank
440
you.
Pages, Alan and Unwin concussed. There is a picture section in the middle which enthuses me.
There are a couple of jokes in there, believe it or
and
not, as well.
So,
I
think it's an important conversation to have. Look up, Sam. Where can people find you on social?
Sam Peters, Steve Diamond.
On your Twitter's...
The only fight you've never had and never lost.
Planted Sam.
At Planted Sam. That's my Twitter handle. Please don't abuse me.
We want to get to Sarah's joke, but you are listening on Devon's Radio X. Our final point, Coxie is an official, and the first conviction of somebody abusing official has been ratified
gone to off the field now.
Can we have a quick word from our sponsors and also from Statman?
Oh, let's have Statman and the sponsors, and then we'll go on to our final piece.
Two Locks and a Cox
from Devon's Radio X with Exeter Chiefs. The next match against Bath is on Saturday, the 20th of April. Book your tickets today at tickethub.exeterchiefs.co.uk.
Hey Dave, I'm still on a bit of a high from the massive and monumental but never in doubt win at Sandy Park with 15,000 people. We saw you there. It was great to see you. And how did you? What did you make of it?
It was one of the great Sandy Park afternoons, I think. It was just such an incredible team effort, especially second half. We'll talk about it in a minute. Just the sheer colossal effort that was put in by the players. And actually, I think you could make a case for the final score not really flattering Chiefs. I think, you know, they could have got more potentially. As it was, they got 21 points. That's the first time, and this is one of those weird coincidence stats to start off with. The last time they scored 21 in the Champions Cup was against Glasgow in January 2018. That Glasgow side featured one Finn Russell.
Wow.
And Stuart Hogg and Johnny Gray. I think that was when we went to Glasgow for a Rob Baxter shopping trip. The last side to score 15 points at Sandy Park against Chiefs was also Bath last Christmas Eve before last, so just over nearly 18 months ago. And that's the lowest score Chiefs have conceded so far this year. So really great day all round on that.
Knockout rugby, isn't it? Knockout rugby is so different.
Yeah, knockout rugby. And the Chiefs with that experience, and as we said last week, that's now 18 knockout wins, or not the times they've progressed from 20 knockout games at Sandy Park in the last 11 seasons, which is absolutely staggering. And for someone who gets paid to go to games by the game, these knockout wins are really lovely. So yeah, that's really good.
We can keep ticking the stat, which is they've not won since 2016, and now it's 11.
Yeah, now it's 11. Let's hope that that stat's still in place in a fortnight.
Exactly.
And just took the colossal effort and the sort of the magnitude of the game at the weekend. Obviously, that wind was absolutely insane. I sadly don't have a wind speed, but high, I would guess. Bath made over 200 tackles. One count I've seen was as many as 239 tackles during the game. Chiefs had 68% possession, even during the second half when they were playing into the wind. In the first half, that possession was over 70%. A couple of individual stats to pick out. Ethan Roots carried the ball 25 times.
That's some work rate.
Which is absolutely insane. I think Ross Vincent was on for a similar number. He carried the ball 14 times in the 45 minutes he was on the pitch. Not bad for a lad whose nose is still halfway across his face. And Emmanuel Faye-Wabosso beat 15 defenders, which is the highest in the Champions Cup for 14 years.
The post-contact meters were the most impressive with him.
Yeah, I was going to say, and he beat most of them by running through the middle of them.
So, yes.
absolutely incredible individual performances and an amazing all-round team performance, I think. Chiefs now have got the most carries and the best scrum in the Champions Cup so far this season. So, yeah, all positive stuff. Takes us on to Toulouse next week on Sunday. Toulouse, arguably one of the best teams in Europe. It's quite a daunting trip. But I've got a couple of stats to try and keep us optimistic this week. So the first one is Chiefs' record in France over the last few games that they've played there is loss, win, loss, win, loss, win, loss, win, loss, win, loss. So every other game's a win. So we're due for a win.
Good.
Obviously, the last win and loss were this season. That's the first time Chiefs have played three games in France in the same season. And a real omen for us that we can cling to for until Sunday night and hopefully beyond is that in 2020, when Chiefs won the competition, they conceded 13 points against Northampton. So that's quite close to 15, isn't it? So they played an English side at Sandy Park in a knockout game, beat them, kept them at arm's length. They played Toulouse the following weekend and beat them as well in the semi-final, as it was then. So we've got 100% record against Toulouse so far. So let's hope that continues. It's not a great prospect in the Champions Cup. In the last two seasons, 21 out of 23 home teams have won in the knockout stages. So it's quite a tall order.
It's a monumental bill, and Tony Walker, the team manager, is a great friend of mine, and was obviously Saturday after the game, and we'd won, or he already had things lined up, was fast trying to, you know, look at flights and hotels, get stuff all pre-booked, but you can't commit until Sunday night and when Racing lost. So, yeah, let's hope for that one. We've got a really poorly advertised women's game as well, haven't we?
Yeah, it sort of snuck up a little bit. I think the fact that they've not played for a few weeks because of the Six Nations has kind of caught everyone out a little bit, possibly. The women are at Saracens in the Allianz Cup semi-final. So the Allianz Cup, Chiefs have won it the last two seasons, been pretty unstoppable in the competition. But they're up against their record at Saracens, which is played four, lost four. Their best result actually was a cup game up there, which was abandoned. So not the best place historically for Chiefs, but I think it's potentially a bit of a free shot to try and end that run. With all the Six Nations going on, I'm guessing there'll be a bit of a change. It's not going to be the same Saracen side they faced earlier in the year. Who knows, really?
Yeah, nor is it going to be the same Chiefs side with lots of girls away and Kleeman only just being called back to Ireland. Yeah. So, Yeah, well, let's fingers crossed on that one. And then there's a stat with the Stonex and the women that we can cross off. So
yeah, the more we talk about these stats, the less likely they are to continue. That's the way I see it. So yeah, let's hope that our jinx is lifted this week.
Awesome, great week. Thanks for that. We'll catch up next week after the Toulouse game, and yeah, we'll start looking forward to Bath's second visit to Sandy Park.
Yeah, and with a Allianz Cup final and a Champions Cup semi-final on the horizon as well, hopefully.
Sounds perfect. Thanks, Dave.
See you next week.
Two Locks and a Cox.
From Devon's Radio X with Exeter Chiefs.
The next match against Bath is on Saturday the 20th of April. Book your tickets today at tickethub.exeterchiefs.co.uk.
And we're back. There were some interesting stats from Statman there. So, Coxie, the chap has been found guilty of abusing an official. How you feel about that?
Yeah, it's good. So we've got some really good protocols in place now. So what we've got is an algorithm that runs in the background that basically searches people's names, specifically around referees, and then picks up on what that looks like. And they can go into your DMs as well. It looks across the entire platforms and pretty much flags what they believe is coming up as abusive. And what people do, I don't think, realise is that you can now be criminally charged for abuse over social media. And I think this highlights it now.
And this was in Australia. The first one was in Australia, wasn't it?
Yeah, I believe at the moment they are looking, I think, and I'll have to properly look at this, but I think it's around about 20 plus cases that they've got going through.
Yeah, the press said there were 33. The first one was, I think it was England, Georgia, and it was an Australian who put abuse on.
Yeah. So 30 plus cases that are currently going through the criminal justice system in each of those countries that have been flagged by this piece of software.
As a top level official, how does that make you feel?
Great. It makes me feel like I'm protected.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important that people understand that just because you want to sit there and hide behind a keyboard, you don't hide anymore. And this piece of software can do lots and lots of different things to get to basically the root cause of where this is coming from. But, you know, I don't want to go into the full details of that case that's gone through, but the abuse was disgusting, like really, really awful. And some of the data that we've had come through off the back of the World Cup, the highest abuse rate against one referee was Wayne Barnes, and he was number one in, and that's out of all the players. Sia Khaleesi was up there. Carl Dixon was up there in the top five. So the abuse rates, and especially around specifically to people, and threatening to fine people's schools. And they go as far as to find addresses so that they can prove that they know where you are.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, because Tom Foley went into that in quite some depth. I've read it through X and followed this through about the people being prosecuted. And then there was a South African bloke jumped on there and, Wayne Barnes has earned his place there, isn't he, on an article about them being done genuinely. And then went into the reasons why he thought that was okay.
We've had quite a heavy duty pod. We had a bit of fun at the start, and then we've been quite heavy duty. Coxie, have you got your joke now?
Oh yes, I've got my joke. Right, I've had to have reinforcements on this.
Yeah.
There are 48 cows in the field and 28 chickens. How many didn't?
I don't know.
No, come on, this is a little riddle. There are 48 cows in the field and 28 chickens. How many didn't?
Don't know. 20 chickens.
Where are the chickens? Are they in the field?
Yeah, everyone's in the field.
They're in the field,
Sam,
as well.
Have you got any thoughts on
how many didn't what?
Oh,
come on.
Come on, you've got to work it out.
I don't know, it's going to be like Chicky Bow Wow.
No, it's not Chicky Bow Wow.
Come on, what is it? Coxie, tell us the answer.
No, I'm going to leave it out there, and you'll get the answer next week.
Oh, that's a great tease.
All to our viewers as well, or listeners. That is
the list. We're being filmed now. I've been making my nose.
Maybe.
I'm also going and deleting my DMs when I've messaged you saying Stevie Wonder could have refereed that match better than you as a joke, because I hope they don't go into hold things.
Correct. They're coming for you.
Sarah, I was joking.
Okay. Coxie, any other business?
No, I want you to answer that. I want you to have a really good think about it.
I'll come back next week.
You will work this out.
Okay.
This is right up your street.
48 cows
in the field.
28 chickens, who didn't?
28 chickens, who didn't?
All right. Ian, have you got any other business?
No, I'm busy Googling it.
Okay. No, don't Google it.
So I'm going to tip Chiefs to win by a point against Toulouse. I'm just throwing it out there. Sam, any other business from yourself?
I'm going to probably tip Toulouse, sorry.
Yeah, well.
Well, you're never coming back.
No, I'm the most one I know. We're all good. Two Locks to Cocks, episode 35 in the can. Everybody happy with that?
Winning.
Final word, Ian.
I'm lost for words because it's just been fan dabby dozy.
Two Locks and a Cocks.
From Devon's Radio X. With Exeter Chiefs.
The next match against Bath is on Saturday, the 20th of April. Book your tickets today at tickethub.exeterchiefs.co.uk.